This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier this month, a jury in Prince George's County, Maryland, convicted a gang member of shooting and killing a stranger in order to make a name for himself and for his organization. Both the shooter and his victim were 19 years old. The dead man had no connection to the gang known as MS-13 or Mara Salvatrucha. Neither the crime nor its motive are unusual, but the location might surprise some. MS-13 started in Los Angeles and has spread to include member cells throughout the United States, and it's international, too, in Mexico, Central and South America. And while we may hear the name MS-13 in news reports, few know details about how the gang began and grew, what it does, how it's organized, why people join, and what it's like to be a member of MS-13. Today, we'll find out. Later in the hour, William Longavisha joins us to talk about China and the preparations for the Summer Olympic Games. But first, if you know anyone in MS-13 or if the gang's affected your life, give us a call. Our number, 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can tell us your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Susan Cruz. She joins us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. She's a former member of MS-13 and currently works with young people in gangs. Susan, nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
And do you remember a time when you didn't know the name of MS-13?
Absolutely, before it was formed.
When was that?
I'd say early 1980s.
And how old were you when you joined?
Well, in the beginning, there really wasn't a process, an initiation process. It just so happened that it was formed, you know, by a group of Salvadoran kids who were refugees of the civil war in El Salvador. And they found themselves being displaced, forced out of their own countries and into a host country, the United States, where they were excluded and they were discriminated against, including by other Latinos, not to mention whites and blacks and everybody else. So it was just the very nature of being Salvadoran, being a refugee, being a child affected by the war, and now being in a country that was pretty much a hostile environment for and continues to be for immigrants. And so that's basically what formed the gang in the beginning. So I would say that was in the mid-1980s.
Uh-huh. And the way you describe it, the kids had to group together, at least in part, for self-protection.
Absolutely.
And is that why you joined?
Well, yes. Let me put it to you this way. I remember one of my first experiences in this country. I was 8 years old, and I didn't know the games, you know, the kids play. I didn't speak English at the time. To top it off, I was dropped down a grade because I didn't speak English. And so right off the bat, you know, my welcome to this country was that I was lesser than, you know, the other kids. The adults made me feel this way as well. I remember one of my first experiences in the playground. There's this game called Foursquare. We don't play Foursquare in El Salvador. And this, all the kids were yelling at me. I'm sure they were asking for me to pass the ball back. And I didn't know how to play the game. And this girl, I still remember her. As if it was yesterday, blonde hair, blue eyes, she came up and squarely punched me in the nose. And nobody had ever hit me. And this girl, you know, she just punched me. She started wailing on me. And naturally, I had to defend myself. Because I didn't speak English, I was taken to the principal's office and I was suspended for the day. And then, of course, you know, getting home, you know, being suspended, you know, that was, you know, quite a stigma, you know, for my mother. I was reprimanded by her, and so I really felt that my experiences in this country, you know, starting, you know, off with that, they weren't going to be easy, and therefore I needed, you know, to find ways, you know, to survive.
Mm-hmm. But eventually, from a organization of defense and survival, MS-13 can change considerably.
Absolutely. Here's the thing. After, you know, being victimized, you know, so much, people get tired and they start, you know, taking the stance, you know, that they are no longer going to be victimized. And part of switching, you know, from the role of victim to victimizer has a lot to do, you know, with being, you know, feeling like you have no other recourse. And, of course, there's safety in numbers. I remember, you know, being in school and those of us, you know, who were Salvadoran, you know, we would, you know, group together and we would hang out. We would commiserate about how, you know, difficult, you know, things were, about, you know, the situation of our parents, most of whom, you know, were working, you know, two jobs, you know, to try to make ends meet, some of, you know, whom, you know, were emotionally absent or dealing, you know, with their own, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder from the war. And we would, you know, just reminisce about what it was like. And when we were together as a group, we felt like we were home, even though we were far away from home.
The name, Mara Salvatrucha, what does it mean?
Mara is a slang term commonly used in El Salvador, which just means a group of friends. You know, it. If you remember the Little Rascals, you know, they would, you know, all call themselves, you know, the gang, right?
Our gang, it was, sure, yeah.
Right, our gang. And it, basically that's what that means. And, you know, people who are not in a gang in El Salvador, you know, continue, you know, to use the word Mara, you know, to say, hey, you know, our gang's going to go to the beach or we're going to go to, you know, see the movies. That's basically what it means. It means our gang or a group of friends. And Salvatrucha is also slang, you know, for Salvadoran. Unlike, you know, what some other folks, you know, may allude to, it has nothing, you know, to do with having origins with the guerrillas or the leftist movement. It's just a slang word, you know, for Salvadoran.
And 13, where does that come from?
That was something, you know, that happened as the gang, you know, began, you know, to evolve here in Los Angeles, California, as members of the gang who were originally stoners, long hair, would listen to heavy metal, cut off, you know, jeans at the knees, and they would wear Vans. As they would start getting arrested and going into the county jail and the criminal justice system, again, you know, they needed, you know, to go through another process by which they had to assimilate to, you know, prison culture in order to survive. And so they, you know, they changed their look. You know, they started cutting off their hair. Nothing worse, you know, than being a man in prison with long hair. And they started adopting, you know, the Chicano style of, you know, of the gangster. And so with that, they also adopted, you know, the 13, which is something that was here long before MS, and it's part, you know, of the prison politics. It basically has to do, you know, with gang politics here in California, whereby the southern half of California is the south, or, you know, the sur, which is what the 13 represents, and the northern half is 14, or north, which is what the 14 represents.
Okay, so those are the distinctions there. It's been reported that some girls are sexed into gangs and others are jumped in. Can you explain this? And from the way you describe it, there was no initiation when you joined.
Right. Several gangs will have different ways of initiating their members, whether male or female. Some are, you know, grandfathered in, you know, because a family member may already be in the gang, and therefore, you know, any future family members are grandfathered into the gang. Some gangs will have an initiation where they are jumped in, and this is the one that is most commonly known. A group of members will beat up a new, or, you know, a new applicant, I guess. They will beat them up, you know, for a designated number of minutes. And there also, you know, are gangs, you know, that may practice, you know, the sexing in of girls. However, it is very important, you know, to note that even those girls who are sexed into a gang, they quickly recognize that they do not hold the same standing as other females in the gang. And most of them, you know, will basically be cast out, or they will basically, you know, excuse themselves or just fade away from the gang because they quickly realize that their membership status is not the same as the others.
Joining us now from member station WLRN in Miami is Rafael Rodriguez, the supervising producer for Discovery en Español and one of the producers of Mara's A Regional Threat, a documentary that aired on Discovery en Español and will re-air May 4th at 10 p.m. And Rafael, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil. And I'm listening to...
Go ahead.
No, I've been listening to Susan's testimony from L.A., and it's pretty much what Discovery en Español did with this original production last year, that premiered last year, and it's being a huge success with our audience nationwide, our Hispanic community in the U.S., and I guess the first thing I would say is that Susan's testimony is this documentary, this Discovery en Español's documentary, sort of collects the many stories like this, both here in the States, in L.A., and also in Central America, specifically El Salvador and Honduras.
And how is MS-13, Mara Salvatrucha, how are they different from other gangs, do you think?
Like Susan was saying, and this is something that the documentary really explores into depth, Mara Salvatrucha, they're more violent than the initial gang that originated in East L.A., the 18th Street gang. They're more violent. They actually are characterized or they're known by using the firearms instead of the normal stones and sticks gang fights that we used to see before the Mara Salvatrucha 13 originated in the early 80s as a result of the civil unrest in Central America and having all these junters and parents sending their kids to L.A. on a company. And as Susan, she was saying, you know, pretty much they felt as outcasts and they needed to form their own gang to have that sense of belonging. Our documentary, this going Español, I mean, we go into all the different phases. We actually follow within the program one gang member that went through this experience, went to L.A., emigrated to L.A., sort of joined the MS-13 gang, and later was deported back to El Salvador, and he continued his gang activity in Central America. So it's also kind of gang activity between the U.S. and Central America, this part of the region. It also has to do a lot with the entire immigration debate that is an ongoing thing in the region as well.
Okay, Rafael, stay with us, if you will. We'll also speak more with Susan Cruz when we return. We're talking about the MS-13 or Mara Salvatrucha gang when we come back. More about how MS spread across and out of the country. And we'll talk with an agent who's part of an FBI task force on Hispanic gangs. We'd also like to take your calls if you know somebody who's been involved with Mara Salvatrucha or if your life has been affected by this gang. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also check out what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The notorious MS-13 or Mara Salvatrucha gang has spread from the West Coast to the East Coast all the way to South America. We're taking a closer look today at MS-13. We're talking with Susan Cruz, a former member of the gang now working in gang prevention, and with Rafael Rodriguez, who produced a documentary about the gang. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk with an FBI agent who's part of a special unit that investigates MS and other Hispanic gangs. Of course, we want to hear from you, too. If you have experience with MS-13, do you know anyone in the group? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Let's talk. Start with Umber. Umber's calling us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was living in El Salvador for 7 years, and during that time I visited prisons, and I was surprised to see that most of the people in prison spoke perfect English, and they had been deported because of gang activity. And it seems to me that this is a cycle of violence perpetuated by war that we don't often think about living in the United States, where we're so far removed from war. But by the end of the Civil War in El Salvador, half the population was under 18 years old, and there were a lot of kids living on the streets. There was little food. There's still no jobs. So there's mass immigration to the United States, where, as your guest mentioned, kids aren't assimilated. And I think we hold so much fear against people that are different from us, and they have lived through so much violence. I mean, a lot of these kids grew up seeing nothing but violence as a way to resolve problems. And, you know, just dead bodies in the streets and really just terrible, terrible things. And so what is the way that they see to come together and to solve their problems? And then when they get involved in that kind of activity, they get deported and sent to prison in a country that they don't know as home. And it, you know, it's to the point now where El Salvador has so much violence that I lived there for 7 years. We moved here 2 years ago. And the last time we went back, which was in February, the violence was so bad that I actually can't imagine going back now with my children because I just really fear for my safety. And it seems to me that the only way that we will ever, ever see peace is if we acknowledge that even our enemies' children need to be loved so that they don't have to end up in situations like this. that we just have to be accepting of differences, or the consequences are so far-reaching and generational that we'll never escape the cycle of violence. I'd like to know what Susan thinks about how the war affected her life, even though she grew up in the United States.
Susan?
You know what, first and foremost, I want to thank you. I think that is perhaps by far the most insightful commentary I've heard, you know, from someone that lives here in the United States. But a lot of it also has to do because you took, you know, the time, you know, to travel to El Salvador and get to see, you know, the conditions, you know, see the environment. And you went out of your way, you know, to see what was going on. And I think, you know, really that's what, you know, what people need. I think, you know, there's so much hype, you know, in the media. And I think people just settle, you know, to believing, you know, what this campaign of fear, you know, that has been, you know, brought on, you know, about, you know, people from other countries. Even though I came here at a very young age, I was very much affected, you know, by the war from the get-go. I've had family members killed. I had my mother taken away from me when I was 8 years old. She was tortured. And a lot of it had to do, you know, because of her speaking out against, you know, this government, the Salvadoran government, who continues, you know, to violate, you know, human and civil rights, who continues, you know, to literally get away with murder. And this is something, you know, really important that I want to let people know. Taxpayers have financed all of this. When you look at a gang like MS-13, MS-13, it really is, you know, the U.S. taxpayers, you know, gang. They, you know, have contributed, you know, to its formation, you know, to its growth, to its spread, you know, through deportation and, you know, through everything, you know, that's being done. All the suppressive tactics that have been applied, you know, to this gang have only, you know, made it, you know, grow. And instead of, you know, fixing, you know, what people seem, you know, to think, you know, is going, you know, to be a quick fix, all they're really doing is just, you know, helping the gang, you know, grow. All, you know, through taxpayers' you know, dollars. And people need to understand that. Now, back, you know, to your question. I went back to live in El Salvador in 1985, and I also went back from 1993 to 1996. After the signing of the peace accords in 1992, I went back to my country because I always longed to go back. I had been brought, you know, here to this country against my will as a child, had suffered all sorts of indiscrimination and injustice, because of, you know, where I was from and, you know, what I represented. And I went back and I lived over there for 3 years. And I worked, you know, for an American trading company. And these folks, they basically supplied, you know, the military and the police with a lot of, you know, products and services. And it was in those 3 years where it really opened up my eyes to realize, you know, the gangs are often, you know, the scapegoat and basically the catch-all for all, you know, to be, you know, to be blamed, you know, for all of society's ills. But really, gang members don't own the airstrips where the Cessnas, you know, fly in from South America, you know, with drug shipments. They don't own the marinas or the boats where a lot of these drugs, you know, are brought in. They don't work in customs offices. They are, you know, they do not hold, you know, public offices, and they don't take, you know, the huge bribes, you know, that a lot of these government officials, and they're not in cahoots with U.S. officials as well, in terms of, you know, maintaining, you know, these miserable, you know, economic conditions in these countries that, you know, cause, you know, people, you know, to escape and, you know, to head, you know, up here to the United States. So this is something, you know, that I have seen, you know, firsthand.
Let's see. I just want to get to another caller before we...
Sure.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's get to Sophia. Sophia with us from Jacksonville in North Carolina.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Oh, I just want to tell you this story about my stepdad. He was a singer, and he wrote songs about how he didn't like to grow up around gangs and just how miserable he was growing up, you know, around those people. And part of these people from MS-13 didn't like his song, so they murdered him last year, actually, around this time.
They murdered him?
Yes, they did, because of the songs.
I'm very sorry for your loss, Sophia.
We are, too. Actually, it was the 24th, so it's going to be almost a year now that they murdered him.
Yeah. Sophia, thanks very much.
It's just really sad that these people don't have a heart, you know, and because of a song, they took him away from us. And he was a great person. He was a great singer. He had a very, very great talent, and it is just awful.
Thank you, Sophia. Mm-hmm. Joining us now by phone from Los Angeles is Robert Clark, Supervisory Special Agent of the Hispanic Gang Task Force for the FBI. And Agent Clark, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Mr. Conan. Thank you for having me.
And tell us a little bit about the organization of MS-13, whatever its origins. How big is it now?
Well, according to the statistics provided by the MS-13 National Gang Task Force in Washington, D.C., they number anywhere from 10 to 12 to 15,000. Here in the U.S., and certainly in Los Angeles, we have a large proponent of MS-13.
And what kind of businesses are they in?
Predominantly drug trafficking and extortion. They predominantly extort their own people that are attempting to make a living by, you know, selling fruits on the street corners and any of the other legitimate businesses that operate in neighborhoods that are predominantly Salvadoran residents.
So protection rackets, that sort of thing.
Yes, sir.
And how organized is it? Is it a hierarchical structure?
It's extremely organized. We've been able to document through source reporting and in our investigations that they are conducting an elaborate extortion schemes where individuals who are selling various items from food, fruits to CDs to clothing, whatever they're selling legitimately or illegitimately and on the streets that they are paying a taxation, which is a part of the cycle of victimology that they have experienced in El Salvador.
And would you agree, I don't know if you heard Susan Cruz speaking earlier, but saying that in effect, a lot of this has been subsidized by the taxpayer, that inadvertently the process of deportation has just spread this gang's growth?
Well, certainly the process of deportation is outside the guise of the FBI. Certainly the individuals who are here in the United States illegally that are involved in crimes and punished and subsequently deported are carrying with them the knowledge and the model of gang enterprise and gang activity with them when they go back. And certainly that has been one of the issues that we continue to deal with.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. And this is Myrna. Myrna with us from Roanoke in Virginia.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I guess my question would be for Mr. Clark. I'm from Bolivia, and it happened that today I read a newspaper, the local newspaper in my city, and one member of this gang in Los Angeles was caught because he had assassinated two individuals. He actually went, was deported and joined a gang and became actually the leader of the gang, the local gang. My question is, are local authorities aware when these individuals are being deported back to these localities, and what are they doing? Are they trying, and if they do, are they prepared to deal with the kind of crime they're bringing? We are very aware that, yeah, Latin America and especially South America has a lot of political unrest right now, but the crime that the gang members bring, I think, changes the landscape of crime for these regions. So the question again is the Bolivian government or the local government aware of these people, and are they doing anything to make sure that they are under some sort of check or rehabilitation program or whatever it is, or nobody knows what who's going back or not?
Well, thank you for your question. I'm not familiar with the government of Belize because a majority of my work...
Bolivia,
because a majority of my work is conducted with Central America, and that being El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, Chiapas, Mexico.
But if somebody's being deported to Chiapas or to El Salvador, do you notify the local authorities there that...
Yes. There's an exchange of information on deportees, so they are aware of the individuals that they are receiving back into their countries. And we continue to monitor that activity through several initiatives that the FBI and other federal and local agencies are involved in nationally as well as transnationally.
Hmm. Myrna, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email question from Joe in Chandler, Arizona. Does MS-13 have centralized leadership? If so, where is it based, and are they known? Agent Clark?
We have not identified what we would call centralized leadership. What we have identified is that there are numerous cliques that are operating, and they generally maintain a leadership infrastructure within that specific clique, that specific neighborhood or region of the country. We have seen that they continue to talk to one another because gang members are moving, not necessarily gangs, but gang members move across the United States for work or with family or whatever reasons they decide to move. So they certainly continue to maintain communication and connectivity with one another along those lines.
And earlier, Rafael Rodriguez, who's one of our guests, was saying that this gang is characterized by exceptional violence. Do you think that that's accurate?
Yes, it is. They are obviously, as has been shared by our other panel members, that they come from a culture of violence through the Civil War process that occurred down there during the early part of the 90s. And, you know, certainly they come with them a certain tolerance and acceptance and understanding of violence and understanding just what violence means in terms of translating into power and control and influence.
SSA Clark, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome, sir.
Robert Clark, Supervisory Special Agent of the Hispanic Gang Task Force for the FBI, joined us by phone from Los Angeles. We're speaking with Susan Cruz, a former member of MS-13, and Rafael Rodriguez, the supervising producer for Discovery en Español. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Michael. Michael calling us from Napa in California.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, and thank you very much for bringing this topic to light. I think it's really important. I lived in El Salvador between 2004 and 2005 for a period of 13 months and have been back for 5 or 6 times since then. And when I was down there, I was doing volunteer work for a number of different organizations, and I was actually assaulted one day when I was taking a local bus. I lived in an area that was pretty well known throughout the country for having especially high gang activity. And I got on a bus, and two gentlemen who had tattoos all over their faces and heads, their heads were shaved so you could see all their tattoos, and they were very easily identifiable as members of the Mara Salvatrucha. And as soon as I got on the bus, I heard them say, American, followed by a very derogatory term in Spanish, and I, for my own safety, I didn't let them know I understood it, but I then listened to them on the bus, and they were talking about how they were going to kill me. And somehow I very narrowly avoided being stabbed by these two gang members and was able to get away. But you touched on it just a minute ago. The point of this and what I want to bring up is the fact that our deportation and our foreign policy really is perpetuating this problem. And as we're facing this huge question of immigration reform and all these issues that we're facing around that, I think we really need to take that in consideration, and how we handle these people that are violent, and just sending them back to their own country is not a solution. In fact, it's the complete opposite, and it's putting our American community members that are down in these countries doing good work and traveling and just enjoying themselves, it's putting them in danger. But as we're learning, as the gentleman from the FBI said, there's up to 15,000 in the United States of these gang members. It's now putting us in danger at home by creating this animosity.
Rafael Rodriguez, that circular problem that your documentary focuses on in terms of the immigration problem.
Yes, as we actually profile in last year's Discovering Español, Mara's original threat. This is a vicious cycle, you know, back and forth between the States and Central America. And as the gentleman was saying, you know, these gang members in the different neighborhoods in El Salvador, they normally, based on their territories, they control certain territories, and the documentary shows that. And this is one of the ways they have to make money. They normally have people or gang members assigned to the different public transportation buses, so they get on this bus and they try to make sure the people on the buses at that time, they either assault them or they get money from them and everything else. And, you know, and the what I was listening before, it's kind of true, and the documentary touches on this as well, that deportation without proper rehabilitation from and prevention more than anything else. I mean, there are a lot of these countries that are not doing or putting budgets to actually prevent the things for our younger kids to get into the gangs, and there are not really all the rehabilitation programs that they need. The documentary follows this specific case of a girl that through rehabilitation, she's getting out of the gang and she's taking care of herself and her family. And this is something that they should also think about, that they need more of these programs down there as well as here.
Susan Cruz, we just have a very few seconds left, but is MS-13 growing, or is it is this a growing problem?
Well, the growing problem here is that people fail, you know, to accept the gangs, you know, fill society's voids at a high price. And there's always a lot of talk about prevention and so forth. I'm one to always advocate for the public health model. You need a comprehensive approach and an integrated approach, you know, to deal with folks, you know, who may be thinking of joining a gang, who already are in a gang. That's a crucial population. And there's not enough, you know, that's being done, you know, to address that issue. So I think people are just
I'm afraid I have to cut you off because we're out of time. Susan Cruz, thank you so much for being
with us.
Our thanks also to Rafael Rodriguez of the Discovery en Español. Coming up, we're going to be talking about Beijing and its preparations for the Olympics. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the University of South Carolina, dedicated to changing the world through excellence in research, education, and outreach. Online at sc.edu. From UPS, providing companies with a range of freight solutions by air, ocean, or ground. Discover more at ups.com/whiteboard. And from Raymond James, independent financial planning advice, asset management, and investment banking. Individual solutions from independent advisors. RaymondJames.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
1885-6-ish was when I think the house was approximately built.
What do you get when you gut a 115-year-old row house?
Yeah, lots of reuse, lots of salvage, and I'll show you kind of when we walk through sort of little places where we did that.
And turn it into an environmental building showcase.
My bills here are about half of what they were all winter.
An old house goes green today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Our house in the middle of our street.